Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. My guests today, 100 years on from women getting the vote, are feminist trailblazers. Writer and journalist Nell McCafferty, academic Micheline Sheehy Skeffington, granddaughter of leading suffragette Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Mary McAuliffe, historian and lecturer on gender studies at GCD, and feminist historian Margaret Ward, who'll be talking about her book on Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. Our text number is 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. You can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, first up this morning, we have a great competition prize for you, our listeners. Elton John recently announced details around his epic 3-year farewell tour. Tickets, of course, sold out immediately, but an extra date was added at the Three Arena for June the 13th, 2019. And we have a pair of tickets for this concert to give away this morning. All you have to do for a chance of winning them is answer this very simple question. Elton John won an Oscar for Best Original Song with Can You Feel the Love Tonight? And we want to know, what movie was the song from? Was it A, The Lion King, or B, The Jungle Book? Text your answer A or B and name to 51551 and we'll announce the winner before the end of today's show. Now for some great big band music, which is our musical guest of the day. Conor McKeown and his band are known for playing songs from the Great American Songbook. And this coming Thursday, they're performing their Legends of Swing concert in the National Concert Hall here in Dublin. Well, they came into our Studio 8 here in RT to play for us. And first up this morning, the one and only Come Fly With Me, made famous by Frank Sinatra in 1957. That was the great Conor McKeown there and his band. And I've got Nell McCafferty and Mary McAuliffe dancing around the studio here, isn't that right, Nell? And they're performing, Conor McKeown and his band, next Thursday, February the 15th, their Legends of Swing, here in the National Concert Hall in Dublin. And there are some tickets left, just a few, on nch.ie. Well, as we all know, it's 100 years since women got the vote. Well, to talk about that fight, to see how far women have truly travelled and how much further we might need to go, I am joined this morning by feminist trailblazers, writer and journalist Nell McCafferty, academic Micheline Sheehy Skeffington, who's granddaughter of the leading suffragette Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Mary McAuliffe, historian and lecturer on gender studies at GCD, and the feminist historian Margaret Ward, who recently wrote a definitive book on Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. Good morning to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning, Miriam.
Can I say Miriam?
And I'm Nell. I love you, Nell. Nell Live is always fascinating.
It's the introduction sounds as though I'm here to, because I'm 100 years old, and I'm not. I'm actually 73.
And you're looking good in it now. I'm going to actually go, first of all, to Micheline, who's in our Galway studio. Good morning, Micheline.
Good morning, Miriam.
Thank you very much for joining us. And I know during the week you smashed the window, in a sense, which, remind my listeners, Micheline, for those who don't know enough about your grandmother, tell them about Hannah Sheehy Skeffington and the important role she played.
Well, she was probably one of the most prominent, she was certainly the most prominent militant suffragette. They took that name, they espoused that name, the suffragettes, as the militant women. And in 1912, the Home Rule Bill was going to ignore the votes for women. The Irish Parliamentary Party had wanted to have nothing to do with it. They had a big public meeting and sent a petition to the parliamentarians, and that was completely ignored. So they decided to put into action a direct action that they had planned for a while, and that was to smash windows in public buildings. And that's why I did smash some windows on last Tuesday, just to kind of mark the occasion of what actually won the vote for women. We're commemorating, it was the centenary on Tuesday, of women getting the vote, but it was the actions of all the militant and the non-militant and all the suffragists and people constantly battering the parliament, saying we want 50% of the population wants the vote as well and wants access to it. So
you have a reading there, haven't you, Micheline, that I think is the words of your grandmother Hannah, yes, about the window smashing. Would you read that for us?
That's,
and just
right,
put,
yeah,
it into context.
It's in her memoirs, which is Margaret Ward's recent book. So I'll read out the piece about this. To my lot fell Dublin Castle. I especially asked for it when we were planning our attack. The treasured wrongs of 50 years, etc. Ship Street was the venue near the castle gate. The panes were small and very dirty. I expect they still are. And the garrison was near at hand, so I did not get far with the breakage. Only enough, as it proved, for a 3-month stretch. The custom house GPO band got 6. The policeman who grabbed my arm instinctively seized the right. And, as I'm left-handed, that gave me a chance to get in a few more panes before the military arrived and my escort led me off.
And of course, Micheline, this week you smashed a window as yes. your grandmother had done. And interestingly, you're left-handed
as well. And I grew up being told, it's one of the things I remember, is that, you know, I'm left-handed, you're left-handed like your grandmother. And she was proud of that fact because she was able to get some more paint smashed before the police led her away. And it's only later you think, this is a little bit, you know, not many young girls are told to be proud of their grandmother who was left-handed and smashed windows and went to prison. But there was definitely family pride in that. And yes, I am proud to be left-handed. And I use my left hand. We did a reenactment. The reason for this was because we wanted to have a plaque put up at that spot, at the Ship Street entrance, to commemorate a piece of suffrage action. Because the blue plaques normally say, you know, so-and-so lived here or Hannah taught here in Rathmines. But this was the very first plaque which commemorates suffrage action. And I'm very grateful. The OPW were not only up for it, they own the Dublin Castle, so we needed their permission. But they said, why don't we have a reenactment? So they organised and facilitate the reenactment. And we had some glass panes, which I was able to smash on the day.
Fair dues to them, actually. Margaret Ward, you're in Belfast. Thank you very much for joining us. You've written this wonderful definitive book on Hannah Shee Skeffington. People talk about her being the most significant feminist of the 20th century. Put her in context. How important was she?
Yes, I mean, she was. And I don't want to ignore the fact that from 1876 women were campaigning for the vote. But I think what's significant of Hannah is not only was she a militant campaigner for the vote, but her political career continued until the day she died in 1946. So she was not only somebody who inspired all of the women in the Franchise League, but she was somebody who had the confidence of men like James Connolly. And I really believe that she and her husband Frank were instrumental in the proclamation being so far-sighted as to give men and women equal rights, equal opportunities, and to promise the suffrage of all the people, and to be addressed to the Irish men and Irish women, which was a revolutionary act, as Hannah herself says. So when she goes to America for 18 months after the murder of her husband, she, you know, is lauded by John Devoy, the old Republican, as having done more to further the Irish cause than anyone else. She's somebody whose stature is such that she was able to see Prime Minister Asquith after the murder of her husband, get a public inquiry. When she comes back, Sinn Féin and the Labour Party both want her to be members. She becomes a leading member of Sinn Féin and continues to be a significant figure in Irish political life. Now, she could have had, I think, cabinet office and things like that if she had been willing to compromise her politics. She wasn't, and so she ends up on the radical fringe as always, but a really important voice, and her writings throughout, very acute, very perceptive, show the establishment of the Free State and how the idealism of 1916 so quickly gets eroded.
And they had a sense of humour as well. I was reading your book last night, Margaret, which I enjoyed very much. And remind people how I think she and some of her young female colleagues stormed the Young Ireland branch of the United Irish League and they took the men by surprise. Is that correct?
That's right. And it's the only branch that had women members, but because they went down and she says plonk their money down in front of the surprised official who really didn't want to take it, and they were there. But, you know, it was a coterie of the Sheehy Skeffingtons, Cruise O'Brien, Tom Kettle, Mary Kettle. I mean, a very tight tight-knit group of people who were determined. I mean, Hannah herself, her father was an Irish MP. She understood the importance of the vote. They, you know, within their lifetime, Catholic emancipation was still being talked about. So the idea that Irish parliamentarians were going to ignore women and not have them there was something that she couldn't bear. But they didn't continue with that because, and I think one of the reasons that the Irish Parliamentary Party ignores women to the extent that it does is it doesn't have women in its ranks pushing it, unlike the other political movements in Ireland.
And I suppose, Micheline, just to go back to you for the moment, one of the issues that exercises, I suppose, many historians, I think, as if you said, is the perceived dichotomy between the feminist suffrage movement and the nationalists.
Yeah, that's right. It's partly a perceived dichotomy because obviously they had they were friends. Like Constance Markovitz was a good friend of the Sheehy Skeffingtons, but many of them, and Nina Hearn, for example, in Anne Markovitz said, "Well, we shouldn't be campaigning for the vote in an alien government. Let's get independence first." And Hannah was one of those who said, "Well, I'm all for independence. I'm every bit behind you on that, but I'm not going to wait. I'm going to campaign still for the vote." So they were nuances, if you like. They were pretty well on the same page, but Hannah never joined, of course, any Nina Hearn or indeed Cumann na mBan, because she saw them as secondary to the Volunteers, which never allowed women into it.
We have a short clip, actually, of Maud Gonne McBride. I think it's only about 50 seconds, but here she's paying tribute to the young women who fought for the suffragette movement. Let's listen to that now, Sheila.
I come to quit a debt of honour. I would not die happy if I left unpaid. And I thank Radio Erin and my friend John Brennan for helping me to do so. This debt I owe to the young girls who at my call at the end of last century came together to form the first organized woman society for Ireland's independence in Nina na Hearn. As the founder, I got credit, which belonged to these girls, who did all the real work, and who once started, acted on their own initiative. For I was constantly away, lecturing in America, England, Scotland, France, Holland, Belgium. And because their work was so fruitful, I think it right that this should be understood.
From the RT archive there, thanks to them, Maud Gonne McBride. We're going to finish talking about Hannah in a moment, but just one last thing. Micheline, you have a second reading of Hannah in her own words when they got the vote. Would you read that for us?
Yeah, that's right. And just to comment that the Nina na Hearn wasn't the first suffrage movement. It was much more about Republican causes. And Hannah founded the Irish Women's Franchise League, indeed, in 1908. But here, yeah, there's the Irish Citizen was founded by my grandfather, Francis Sheehy Skeffington, and by James Cousins as the strong female suffrage nationalist paper, and was founded in 1912 and covered everything to do with the vote. And it still continued after 1916 when Frank was tragically murdered. And indeed in 1919, then Hannah writes a year, October 1919, a year after the elections, and she says, "The Irish Citizen still continued its feminist and suffragist propaganda and hopes to do so until all women have the vote equally with men, and until women have secured the other rights that enfranchisement involves, of which the vote is but a small part and but a symbol. We want equal pay for equal work, equal marriage laws, the abolition of legal disabilities, the right of women to enter the hitherto barred learned professions, women jurors and justices, in short, the complete abolition of various taboos and barriers, social, economic and political, that still impede women's progress and consequently that of the race."
Wow,
it's a pretty powerful piece. Yeah, and I think it's so relevant still today that I've just had to quote it today.
Yeah, Micheline, I'm wondering, never having broken a window in my life, what was it like for you to smash glass last night?
Quite fun. It was actually sugar glass, which is easier to smash in some ways and not so dangerous. But yeah, great.
Well,
I was
kind
all
of
up
glass?
For it. It's made of actually sugar. They make it up in, you know, in panes, and because they inserted a window into the window frame. And there were six panes. And speaking of ceilings, the first blow was into the windows. But I must say, the glass ceiling is a hell of a lot thicker and harder to smash.
No, the reason I'm interested in windows, Micheline, is that it seems to be a recurring theme now. When Albert Reynolds was first appointed Minister for Post and Telegraph in the 1970s, at a time when he had to wait 10 years to get a telephone line installed. On his first day in the job, he was taken around his territory and he noticed a broken window at a basement level. At a basement level window, he noticed a broken glass, and he said, "How long has that been there?" And the worker said, "Oh, for ages." And he said, "I want that glass replaced by the time I've finished my round of duty, which would be in 2 hours' time." And I thought that day, I was very struck by it and thought, well, if he can get glass fixed in 2 hours, what will he do with the telephones? And sure enough, within a year of his taking office, the telephone list was reduced. You can now get a telephone on order, which makes me wonder, is there any window one could smash to...
Could I just say
to change the force the government to build houses?
But as a spectator watching Michelin smash that window, it was very moving, because you could see just the kinds of anger and frustration that women in Ireland must have had at that time, feeling that there was going to be home rule for Irish men and not for Irish women. And there's this desperation at coming along and smashing those windows. It was a fantastic reenactment.
And I think also it's to mark the courage of women who did that. I mean, Hannah was there virtually on her own at 5 a.m. outside Dublin Castle, which was presumably full of military. And I want to mark the other, women generally who do that, because it's not easy, And I think it's very important that we commemorate and mark and respect people who stand up and say unpopular things and do unpopular things. And indeed, I could refer to my own tribunal and the five women who stood up against their employer in NUI Galway and still have pending court cases.
Mary McAuliffe here in studio.
I think that was probably one of my favourite commemorations to date so far, and we've been through quite a lot since 2012. But the women continue to do that. If you look at the first commemoration after the Rising in 1917, it is the women who plan and carry out putting tricolours up near the GPO and the College of Surgeons, which was illegal. They weren't allowed to do that. They redistribute and paste up the proclamation. They reprint the proclamation. And Helena Maloney, who had been a member of Inni and the Héireann, a great feminist and suffragist, and would have known Hannah, she said that one of the proclamations they pasted up remained on Grafton Street for over 6 months. So the women were very much into their civil disobedience and smashing windows. And I must say, seeing Micheline smash that window, I would agree with Margaret. It was actually really powerful. Because Hannah was not a very tall woman, and here was this big constable coming down, arresting her, as we saw with Micheline, and Micheline looked so like her grandmother that it was quite emotional and quite powerful seeing it.
Well, just to say, lots of people listening, Linda tweets to say, it's just great to hear women themselves talking about the women's movement rather than others talking about our work. And Grony says, superb listening this morning. We got the vote. We went to prison. Never forget why we still march for other basic rights. Much more to do. Margaret Ward, I'm going to let you go. I just want to mention your book, because it is a wonderful book. It's Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, Suffragette, and Sinn Féin, her memoirs and political writings by Margaret Ward, and it's published by UCD Press. We're going to take a break, but thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Miriam.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551, or email miriam@rte.ie. Well, as we all know, it's 100 years since women got the vote. And this morning, I'm joined by feminist trailblazers, including writer and journalist Nell McCafferty, academic Micheline Sheehy Skeffington, who's the granddaughter of the leading suffragette Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, and Mary McAuliffe, historian and lecturer on gender studies at UCD. And we had just been talking to earlier Margaret Ward, feminist historian, who wrote a great book on Hannah Sheehy Skeffington. Nell McCafferty, you are one of our most famous feminists. Will you, for my listeners, because I know this story, in a sense, what we're discussing this morning is also how far we've come. This story about you buying your television and the hire purchase agreement.
Yes, I got...
And what year it was?
I got my first feminist job my first full-time job in 1970 as a journalist with the Irish Times, and I came down. And within a week of being here, I had my own bedsit in the days when you could change bedsits several times a year, but I went across the road in Rathmines to hire a television set. And the proprietor of the shop said, you need a man to guarantee your payments. And I said, mister, I'm only down here a week. I don't know any men. And I showed him my pay slip, which was 20 guineas a week, just to show the Irish Times was a Protestant background. And he said, no, you need a man. I said, what am I to do? He said, never mind. And he stepped out into the street, tapped a male stranger on the shoulder, brought him in, and the male stranger signed as guarantor of my hiring a TV set. And I said to the man, mister, what do you work at? He says, I'm on the dole. And out he went. And that was my introduction to a working paid woman's paid working life. I was worth nothing.
It's extraordinary. I mean, that's not that long ago now.
Well, 1970, 48 years ago. I suppose the equivalent these days might be trying to buy a house, although there's a hell of a difference, though I don't know.
What formed your feminist principles most? Was it, I suppose, experiences like that, or was it also growing up in Derry?
I remember that the night I railed against the system was we just had a civil rights march in Derry, 5th of October 1968, which was attacked and battered by the Royal Ulster Constabulary. And a meeting was called of the great and the good and the rebellious in Derry in the City Hotel to decide what is to be done next. And though it didn't exclude women, that meeting, I stood outside with my friend of mine, another school teacher, and fuming, I said, why can't we go in? They hadn't specifically asked us, but we also excluded ourselves. It's men only. Though I'm happy to report that subsequently I discovered there was a woman at that meeting. Her name was Sheila McGuinness. The late Sheila McGuinness, an artist married to the late Dr. Raymond MacLean, and Raymond never went anywhere without his wife. Indeed, she probably wouldn't let him out without her. And they went to that meeting that night, and Sheila designed, being an artist, the Derry Civil Rights logo, which was an oak leaf. But that night, as I stood outside in the streets of Derry while the men were inside talking, I was furious and excluded. I knew something was wrong, or I believed something was wrong. Interesting that I excluded myself. We should have gone on.
Well, I think that's the way it happened with women. And I think even despite all the, you know, asking what has changed in the last 100 years, a lot has changed. We've gotten laws, equality laws. I mean, Hannah E. Skeffington, an amazing feminist, kept fighting till the last breath she drew. One of her last campaigns was against the women's, the inclusion of those women articles in the 1937 Constitution, which we are still talking about, whether we leave them in or take them out today. We got equal rights when we joined the EEC. We had to bring our laws in line with equality in the European Community. Campaigns by your organisation, the Irish Women's Liberation People, the Irish Women United, different feminists brought us new laws on, you know, equality, equal pay, equal rights, equal access. But what it didn't change, and I think that's reflecting in what you're saying, it's the culture. It's what we're taught, that, you know, do women really belong on the top table? Are we still being brought up with an idea that we really shouldn't be at the upper echelons in society, that women don't have a voice, that if we raise our voices, we're being shrill rather than powerful? I think that culture is intractable. It's more difficult to change than the laws, and the culture of both exclusion and self-exclusion, because you feel you don't belong. It's like the Me Too thing. People are asking, why didn't women speak up? They didn't speak up because women are supposed to be to acquiesce, to be silent, to accept, to use your feminine wiles to get places. Why do they do that? Because it's the culture. Changing the culture, I think, and that's where I came to feminism, reading Simone de Beauvoir's The Second Sex and the most powerful statement, one is not born a woman, one becomes a woman. You're taught how to be a woman in society. You're taught how to behave, how to take up less space, how not to be so vocal, how not to demand entry into a meeting that is discussing civil rights or entry into a meeting that is discussing anything of importance, because
have we been demanding such things recently?
I think we have been demanding. We continue to demand. I see it with my students who take gender studies now in UCD. Hmm. And more of them are taking it, and it's becoming a core to a lot of what they study. And they are wondering how we change everything. I mean, they look back at what has been achieved, or at least I make them look back, because that's what they're supposed to study. And they wonder, how come it hasn't changed completely? How come it isn't an equal society? It's still a patriarchy.
Yeah, I totally
still
agree.
Have to use that word.
Can I come in there?
Michelin's in Galway.
Today was that, you know, on that day at Dublin Castle too, I'm beginning to think that, you know, equal representation is all very well, but if you're still in that hierarchical system, which is a patriarchal system, is designed by men for men, it's not going to change things that much. You do need to change the culture. And I think a feminist viewpoint would be much more inclusive. And yes, women have to believe in themselves and women have to speak out. I mean, I'm stunned that Nell just stood by while a man signed away, you know, her right to have a television. But, you know, that was the culture then. What do we need now to speak out to change it? And it is, it's a cultural thing. It's not just about getting equality, as in, you know, equal pay and all that. We need to change our attitudes. We need to have a much more inclusive society, which includes everybody. And obviously feminism is also all kinds of other people who are excluded and people who are on the dole. And we go down a whole road with exclusion.
But I mean, how to change that? We were talking earlier, Micheline, about your grandmother, Hannah Sheehy's Gavin, and she assumed that women had equal rights in all domains of Irish life, and she set about putting this in place. But all these years on, you're all saying we're nowhere near that.
Yeah, well, we're not. You know, it takes a long time to do it. And of course, I think there was a backlash. I mean, remember, like, Hannah was lined up to be a minister if the 1916 rising had taken place. Yeah. Women were supposed to get equal suffrage, and indeed men, because they hadn't all got equal suffrage during the 1916 rising. So, you know, and then, you know, there was nobody. And then Hannah was not even given a winnable seat when the first elections happened. She was offered North Antrim.
I
gather Sinn Féin haven't won to this day.
No.
You know, so we kind of slid back down like a frog in a bowl, and I had to come right back up again. But, you know, until we kind of take it as normal for women and young women in particular, I think we're gathering together now again and speaking out and seeing that it is their place to speak out and gain the confidence.
But Micheline, I suppose I can hear my listeners saying maybe, oh, well, we've got two women leaders in Northern Ireland. We've got Theresa May. We've got Angela Merkel. Like, we do have significant women at the top. Mary McCall, if you want to say something.
Again, it goes back to what I was saying. We're still operating. We may have women leaders, but they are operating within a patriarchal culture. It hasn't changed.
And
the suffrage women knew that as well. They weren't just campaigning for the vote. The Irish Citizen had a Watching the Courts brief, which they reported on in the newspaper. And that was young women went down to the courts and they reported on child sex abuse cases, rape cases, all that sort of thing, and horrified at the very, very awfully low sentences that men got, 8 months, 2 years, it wouldn't even be 2 years, because, for example, if a woman had been domestically abused, her husband would be released because he was the breadwinner. You know, this idea that violence against women wasn't really
And you are sitting beside actually Nell McCafferty, who famously wrote for years now those extraordinary pieces on the district courts. So just in relation to what Mary McAuliffe is talking about, you would have witnessed that firsthand down in the district courts.
Yeah, I'm thinking, Mary, as you spoke, didn't Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, she was given 2 months in jail for breaking a window.
She was.
And
as
she was taken away, she said a man who was convicted of beating his wife got far less.
Quite possibly, yeah.
And my memories of the courts are, part of the memories are that women who went in to go bail for their adult children were refused because, as the judges consistently and famously pointed out, well, who earns the money in your house? What have you got? Only the male breadwinner, as they called it then, was allowed to go bail. And the woman said, well, I've got the children's allowance money. And the judge quickly pointed out, well, the children's allowance money is paid to your husband. He might let you keep it, but that's not enough to go bail. We couldn't even do that. But you know what I was thinking, Mary, listening to you all? What I missed this week was the great collective sound of women's voices. And I was thinking, back in the day, not that long ago, every year the Women's Political Association would have an annual general meeting, about a whole day discussing women's issues, and we all turned up in hotels. There'd be thousands of women who would gather to hear that. And I think that stopped about 10 years ago. There wasn't a collective woman's voice this week to discuss where are we and what do we want. And I noted the Dáil had a late night discussion of celebration of the vote. I think it was last Tuesday night. And for half an hour, there were about seven women who spoke. They were limited to 5 minutes each. And hardly any men present. Mm-hmm. They could claim they were sitting up in their office watching it on television. That was it. Apart from, God bless him, John Bowman this morning, who devoted his whole programme to the suffrage thing. And Miriam, I am pathetically ignorant of the suffrage movement. I wasn't taught about it in school, and I don't think I was that interested in it, apart from I knew that some woman had been knocked down by a horse, the king's horse, during the Epsom Derby or something.
Yeah,
people thought that she was throwing herself, committing suicide. In fact,
no, she wasn't.
Put herself forward to pin collars on the horse, and her belongings showed that she'd bought a day return rail ticket to London. From London to Epsom, and she also had bought a return boat ticket to Paris a couple of days after that. But when I listened to all that this morning, I thought, where were we this week?
Younger feminists now are meeting collectively, and they are in different organisations. Because feminism, as Micheline said, is more inclusive now. It's more intersectional. So we look at issues of gender and class and gender and race and sexuality and all of those things. So a lot of young feminists are involved in all sorts of different campaigns, housing campaigns, campaigns about, you know, social inclusion. Obviously all the different campaigns that are happening in Ireland today. So I think while the methods have changed, and perhaps we don't have those grand meetings like the political association had, you get an awful lot done on social media. A lot of young women are meeting in different organisations and then coming together to campaign. So I'm much more positive about the fact that there are thousands of younger women out there campaigning for all sorts of different rights in society from a feminist standpoint and a feminist perspective. And again, I think it's more about, because you could say we have achieved equality under the law. It's about changing hearts and minds. It's about changing other issues. It's about changing the, you know, working class women's lives, traveller women's lives, asylum seekers. Women who live in direct provision hostels, all those sort of things. We're looking at a much broader concept of what feminism
Mary,
means.
Look, Mary, I accept that feminism is in the DNA of every Irish female running around, though she may not be entirely aware of it. But we still need, I think, a collective voice. I need to tune in sometimes and tap in to meetings to find out what we're all looking for, or what we're talking about. There is no sense of a collective ear.
Well, can I say that in Galway, the Galway Feminist Collective is very proactive, and a year ago, I think, or maybe more, they had a march to support the women in direct provision, and there were women from direct provision and ourselves. We all dressed up as suffragettes and marched down the street.
You need to go to Galway now.
We had a Reclaim the Night march, you know, because until women are free to walk the streets, you know, in the same way as men are, we haven't got equality. We are visible. We are doing things. We are. You'll have to join the Galway Feminist Collective, or the Feminist Society in NUI Galway, which is very active. So, I agree. But I was also quite stunned that it was terrific. I got such media coverage. But the reason for it was because there was nothing else organised for that date. On post have no stamps coming out for the suffrage movement. I noticed that the Royal Mail has a whole series with first day issues, and I'm told, and I haven't been told personally, that An Post have a stamp to commemorate Hannah, which is terrific, for a People's Democracy issue along with De Valera, him and De Valera.
Yes, yes, Micheline, but I mean, I could say here, I rest my case. We did not collectively get involved, even to commemorate this year.
Well, with the 100th
anniversary of suffrage.
There were some fantastic.
We're not in on post.
Fantastic organisations commemorating suffrage. And there's going to be another big day where we can commemorate this year, as well as the election, obviously, towards the end of the year in December. But Lough na Mann, June the 9th, 1918, was a huge day for women. It was a day of anti-conscription activism. Conscription had been introduced into Ireland. It was hugely resisted by all sorts of organisations, ranging from the Catholic Church to Sinn Féin to the Parliamentary Party to the Volunteers. But also the Irish Women's Workers' Union and Cumann na Mann organised a huge day on June the 9th. And we are going to commemorate that on June the 9th.
I need to take, a break quickly. I just want to give you just a quick reaction from our listeners. And there's lots. So great to hear Micheline, Mary, Nell and Margaret on Miriam, inspiring women and stories. Need to hear them more. Wonderful words by Hannah Sheehy Skevington, read by her granddaughter. It's crucial that all of the children of the nation are told these stories of our women forebears so that the future can unfold. That's from Anne Byrne. Another woman, Mary in Sligo, says, "Your speakers exaggerate. Women have the same rights as men in our life. Extreme feminists do not speak for the majority of us." Another woman says, "I think young lads need to be educated about gender equality." I'll take one before the break. Miriam, I think the media have a huge role in objectifying women. Pressures on young women to conform to stereotypes is stronger than ever. Some progress, but not enough. We're going to take a break. Join us in a few moments.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Our text number 51551, or you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. As we know, it's 100 years since women got the vote, and we use that as an excuse this morning to have feminist trailblazers here in my studio. Writer and journalist Nell McCafferty, academic Micheline Sheehy Skeffington, the granddaughter of the leading suffragette Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, and Mary McAuliffe, historian and lecturer on gender studies at UCD. Nell McCafferty, when you look back on your life, young woman that you still are, do you feel how you were an ardent feminist? I remember reading lots of your stuff, especially all your district court stuff, all your articles. Do you think we've come a long way or not since the time you had to run out and get a guy to sign your hire purchase agreement to buy television?
Of course we've come a long way. We have left behind what Nuala Fennell called the nightmare of unremitting pregnancy, because we have, for example, the use of artificial contraception is now legal, but we haven't joined the dots. We still have thousands of crisis pregnancies, and when they stand up in the door and talk about it, I am waiting for the men. You mentioned basic things like safe sexual practice. That the first thing you should, before you talk about abortion, the first thing you should talk about is contraception, I believe. I mean, to join the dots, there is a connection between heterosexual intercourse, unprotected, and
you know the contraceptive train, which I've obviously interviewed you a lot about down the years. Did you feel that was a turning moment in the history of feminism? Actually, I'm going to ask Mary McAuliffe, as an historian of feminism and gender studies, because Nell is sitting beside you. That moment, that train that she was very involved in, was that an important moment in modern feminism?
Oh, yeah, it was. And I think the importance of it, the fact that you did it, and actually it has been copied. There have been trains and boats here and there ever since. I think the most important thing about it is it got in the newspapers. It got on, you got on the Late Late, you got talking about feminism. Feminism left like meetings in Dublin and went out throughout the country through doing that direct action activism. And you, that was, you were smashing the window moment, wasn't it? Because you were actually committing an act of civil disobedience. So Nell, you did smash a window. You just did it by going on a train to Belfast and bringing back.
Yes, yeah, obviously it touched a raw, unresponsive nerve in the woman of Ireland. What do you think about it now? The contraceptive pill.
Well, did you bring back you had to take. Well, Disprins instead of...
Yeah, well, when we arrived, when we arrived there, we had not realised. God knows, I was 27. Well, yeah, not really. You needed a doctor's prescription to get
the pill.
And I stood there in the chemist, and there were televisions there. And I said, then I asked for the coil, the loop, trying to remember what all these things are. And finally, and he said, you need a prescription. Finally, I called Virginia Levine, who was Jewish, divorced, a mother, and experienced. I said, June, what are we looking for? And she stepped forward and mentioned all these creams and stuff like that. But we still needed a pill, so I came up with the idea. We bought thousands of aspirin.
Aspirin.
Stripped them out of their packets because we knew the customs men who would greet us in Dublin had never seen a contraceptive pill in their lives. most doctors hadn't seen it. It was an unknown object.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember a couple of months after that, we went to Connemara. I went with a great family planning bag man, Frank Crummy, who distributed these objects. I went down to Connemara late at night, organised by Margaretta Darcy, and all these, what you might call peasant Irish people were there, mostly women, all looking about 80 years of age, or probably 60. They were wrinkled and had shawls. And at the end of the night, and Frank produced all this stuff from his bag, so these are contraceptives now, and I said, well, cash your bag, any questions? And one woman said, no, thank you. It is enough that we have seen this thing. And they went off with their free samples. And I believe the Keeling and Connemara was great. Over the next 6 months, everybody comes to this woman and says, show us these things. They saw them before most people saw them.
Yes. Margaret has texted in to say, Miriam, say thanks to Nell for all her work. She flew the flag when very few did. Hear, hear. Micheline, you're in Galway. I'm conscious that I can't eyeball you. Yeah. Come in on this. And
well, it's again, it's interesting, you know, that you stand up and you do something that's quite unpopular. I mean, I don't know how you felt, Nell, going up, but I'd say there was some trepidation. In fact, you turned up at the chemist in Belfast or wherever and didn't know what you were asking for. But it takes that to kind of highlight
courage,
it.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing, and Mary mentioned it, I think, that it has to get on the media. It has to get noticed. If you do something and nothing happens, then it doesn't get noticed. And I mean, that's basically, there I come back to my university privileged kind of fighting for justice and equality, which I can tell you the culture nor the equality is there yet. But the publicity is what happens. You know, if you start publicising the fact that, no, things are not right, they're not right in cultures and places that you think they should be, then God knows what's the rest of the nation like, you know.
Well, yeah, I can say as an academic working in the same arena that Micheline worked in, that for academic women, Micheline and the five women in Galway taking that stand has been a real moment for us, you know, because that culture of patriarchal culture still exists.
Remind people what Micheline did in a short paragraph, just for people listening who sometimes aren't aware.
Well, yes, Micheline was, and you sued because you weren't promoted, even though you were entitled to promotion, and some men were promoted who weren't entitled to promotion.
Well, I applied four times for promotion, and in 2009 I asked how many women had been promoted, and they had promoted 16 men and one woman.
Yeah.
And I thought I deserved this to senior lecturer. But then I realised that it wasn't just me, that there was something wrong, and eventually the tribunal ruling named seven men who were deficient compared to me. So that's how I knew and had seen everybody's. These are amongst people deemed suitable. All 30 of us should have been promoted had they had the funds.
But again, Micheline, that required courage. I mean, people have texted in to say Nell was courageous. You do have to stick your head above the parapet. I mean, that's not an easy thing to do that you and Nell did.
I mean, I'm lucky that I've got an ancestry and I owed it to them. I knew that I had to do it, you know, and I also knew, to be honest, that, you know, win or lose, that I'd get one headline, at least Suffragette's granddaughter takes case.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, I agreed. And I think that it is important to think, well, you know, maybe not everybody can do that. So if you can, and even if it's just speaking up at a meeting and saying something, then you do it. Because my father used to quote Herbert Spencer, and because he was unpopular. He did a lot of things and spoke out against corporate punishment.
Micheline Nell McCafferty here. I wish, Micheline, you could find a window in Dublin, the targeting of which would allow us to demonstrate that there is no room at the inn for women today who are pregnant.
Well,
that's my biggest obsession. This year is social housing. There is no room. It's a hell of a way to celebrate 100 years on from regaining the vote. Mm-hmm. I don't hear any celebrations of pregnancy in this country. It's not a source of joy. It is not. Simone de Beauvoir, when she had her first and only child, talked about how she felt during the pregnancy, and she talked about the plenitude of pregnancy. Plenitude meaning fullness, fulfillment, that sense of she was joyful. Do you hear anybody singing the praises of motherhood today? And particularly, can you imagine me singing those praises?
I wanted
in
to
the
mention your mum actually now. And we'll go, because we've been talking a lot about Hannah's grandmother. And we're going
to end that. Just to end, one thing is, and I spoke about that, is just to say that women want to command respect.
Yes.
You know, walk in the streets and, you know, being treated with respect in the home.
Yeah.
Not being battered. That's the fundamental thing that we're looking for and that we continue to speak out about.
I know as we close, you wanted to mention your great mum, Lily. She was a great role model for you. Say what you said to me earlier. I said, you know, did you love your mum? And you said to me.
Yeah, I said I didn't just love my mother. I liked her. And that was very important to me. I enjoyed her and I liked talking to her. And she was curious herself about life and loved talking about it. We had many a discussion. But unlike Micheline, I'm not looking for respect in the streets. I'm looking for a roof over my head.
Specialist respect.
This miserable bloody winter we have had. And I think of the homeless.
And they deserve respect. Mm-hmm.
They deserve a roof over their head. It's not that hard. 100,000 houses and homelessness is abolished. Maybe if I could speak in the accents of Constance Markovitz. I love her voice this morning. Could you picture me? Because we'd said in 1970,
Mary, final word to you. And of course, you have a great mother yourself, Nancy.
Yes, I do. And I know she's listening and I want to say hello to her. And my mother inspired me as a feminist. She would have been a feminist in the 1960s and 70s. Yeah. Went back into education, went back and retrained as a teacher, having been married and had four children. And is a great role model.
And of course,
I like my mother too.
Yeah, and great Jean. No, hang on, Nell. Sorry, I'm terrible shutting up you now, but I have to stop you talking for a moment just to say, and also, your mum, of course, is a sister of the great Brendan Kennelly. And shout out to Brendan this morning,
good morning
because
Brenda.
He's such a wonderful poet.
Yes.
Thanks so much. Micheline, thank you so much for joining us. Nell McCafferty, it's always a privilege to talk to you. You too, Mary. I just want to say the winner of our tickets to Elton John today, John O'Sullivan Cardo, you're going to see Elton on his farewell tour. Enjoy it. My producer was Conor Kavanagh, BCO Bridget Nicholas, and sound tuning Eve Whelan and Damien Chanel. We're going out listening to more big band from Conor McKeown. Here it is with Mack the Knife.